You may know today's guest from his 11 years on the TV show MASH, or his 11 years on the TV show Scientific American Frontiers, or his movies, The Seduction of Joe Tynan and The Four Seasons and Sweet Liberty, or maybe his Oscar-nominated role in The Aviator. If I gave you the full list of this man's credits, I would have no time to talk to him. His latest credit is a book called If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? It is based on the work he is doing at his Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, a college that I actually attended for about 20 minutes. Alan Alda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. That sounds like an interesting history you have there.
Well, I majored in not going to classes and instead going to the radio station, which is what kickstarted my career.
I wrote and acted on and directed on the radio station at Fordham where I went to college, and it was a great, great experience.
I tell people if they want to learn about the world, college radio is a great way to do it.
It really is.
The book is about you teaching scientists how to communicate better. When did you first learn they weren't good at this?
You know, it's not so much that they're not good at it. It's that they can all improve if they do what we did together when I did that science program called Scientific American Frontiers. Because what we did was we made contact with each other as people. And then all of a sudden, because they were having to tell me personally about their work and not make a little lecture to the camera, they were talking in much more personal terms. They were making contact with me. They were finding out if I understood them. Because if they weren't finding out from the look on my face, they were finding out from me pulling on their lapel. So I made sure that I did understand, and I wouldn't stop until I could. And that was an interaction that was different from what they usually experienced on television, which is lobbing them a softball question, and they hit it out of the park, but they're not really getting into the mind of the person they're trying to communicate with. And while what we teach there, you know, we've taught at the, not at the center, but the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, we send teachers around the country and to different parts of the world to teach at universities. And we've taught about 8,000 scientists and doctors to communicate better. But the interesting thing is it started with that, and now in the book I realize, and what prompted the book was realizing that this kind of communication applies to everybody. It was really a hint when one scientist said to me, this training has saved my marriage. So I realized with just a little introduction to how you can use it, it's good in business, it's good in selling, it's good in husbands and wives communicating, parents and children, because it's this need to take the perspective of the other person to see where they are and get clues about where they are from their faces and body language and just plain noticing them.
Yeah. I have been doing some work recently with some young entrepreneurs here in St. Louis at some tech startups on how to make their pitches to possible investors. And when they do it before I say anything and I watch their basic pitch, I discover they know way too much about their subject. They are so deep into the woods of their industry or what they're trying to disrupt in an industry or whatever it is. They know so much about it that they can't put it in plain speak.
Right.
Is that what you had to do with the scientists?
Yeah, and there's a name for that. I didn't make it up. It was made up about 20 years ago by a couple of economists. The word for what you just described is the curse of knowledge. And it's not so much that you know too much, because it's great to know stuff. I mean, that we all crave to know as much as we can. But when you know something with so much depth and in such complexity that you forget what it's like not to know it in that depth, then you're cursed with your knowledge. The curse is not knowing it. The curse is forgetting what it's like to not know it.
You know, in the book, you say, along those same lines, that you made a mistake in becoming too over-prepared on those early episodes of Scientific American Frontiers where you were going to go talk to these scientists. I got to tell you, as a lifelong interviewer, being over-prepared sounds like a good thing, not a bad thing. What was wrong?
Well, for me in that circumstance, don't forget, it was an edited interview. It wasn't a live interview.
Right.
So I was free to go in any direction and keep talking. Sometimes we'd talk for an hour or two, and we'd get a 5 or 6 minute piece out of it, mm-hmm. which was then edited. You know, it hit the 5 or 6 minute piece was edited down to something that sounded like I was getting it a lot quicker than I was. but I could roam and I could play, and that gave us more of a connection. But it also avoided the trap of my thinking I knew what they had to tell me. I would, in the beginning, I would read as many of their papers as I could, and I would go in thinking I understood their work, but I would really only half understand it because I didn't have the background that they had, and I didn't understand some basic things about their science sometimes. So I would sometimes ask them questions that I realized later from looking at their face while I was asking them the question that they were in pain because they didn't want to tell me this question is irrelevant or this question is totally ignorant of what I do. They tried to worm their way around to giving me an answer that didn't sound disrespectful to me. But in a way, I was being disrespectful to them because I was assuming I knew more than I did about their work. Mm-hmm. And when I went in with just I had a basic knowledge of it, but I didn't assume I knew more than I knew. And that gave us a real conversation, for one thing. And it also enabled them to explain things in their own terms to me.
You're talking now about reading people's faces. I mean, the name of the book is If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? And you write in the book about responding to visual cues. Does doing this via phone make it harder?
Well, I'm getting your tone of voice. I'm getting the pauses you take. I'm looking for clues all the time in whatever information I get. You know what's really funny? Not only can I get information that I, at least information I think I can use in responding to you on the phone, I find, and this may sound too much to believe, but I believe it's true, that even when I write, if I were writing you, even an email, or writing a chapter in a book that you're going to read or somebody's going to read, I don't know who it's going to be or where they'll be or when they'll be reading it, I can imagine what you're going through as you read each sentence and have an idea of what you're ready to hear in the next sentence. So it's still possible to think about the other person, not only when you can't see them and can't hear them, but you don't know who it's even going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can step back and be the reader for a second, you can say, well, wait a minute, I'm not ready to hear that. Or you just ended the sentence on this. Why are you starting the next sentence on that?
Uh-huh. That seems like it would fall under the grand umbrella of empathy, which you write about a lot in the book.
Yeah, I think it does. But I try to make a distinction. People use empathy in so many different ways, and most of us don't say what exactly we mean by empathy. Some people use it to mean compassion or sympathy for another person or doing good works and that kind of thing. And I don't think so. At least the definition I use of empathy is simply having an estimate of what the other person is feeling as much as you can, try to figure that out. And that can lead to good behavior if you want to do good, or it can lead to bad behavior. I think bullies know they know very well what we're feeling, and they can twist our emotions and make us feel worse. And that they like that, but they'd have a harder time doing it if they didn't read us pretty well.
Are you saying that empathy can be exploited?
Yeah, I call it dark empathy.
Huh.
So, you know, people are constantly whipping us up to do things that we might not otherwise do if we weren't swayed by the way they can manipulate our emotions. Or they sway our emotions to make us buy things we don't need or really want.
Yep.
And we go along with it. Well, they've figured out what'll get us emotionally tagged. They see things from our point of view, and that's not necessarily a good thing. It's not a bad thing necessarily. It might be a good product. But on the other hand, it may just be a way to separate us from our money or from a better set of actions.
Yeah, probably sounds like a really good skill set for a con man.
Yeah, right. Right. I think it's used by psychics and con men routinely. In fact, there was a drug company that got busted. They had to pay a huge fine because they were selling a drug after they knew that it could be harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But the way they were selling it was almost diabolical. At least, maybe that's too strong a term, but they were using the very techniques that I'm talking about. They taught their salesmen how to read the body language of the other people and sense where they were emotionally and that kind. They were using empathy to sell something that wasn't, they had every reason to know it wasn't good.
So you're teaching scientists this empathy, these empathy lessons. Are you also working with doctors? Because there's a field where I think we could probably use a little bit more.
Yeah, we've trained over 8,000 scientists and doctors, and thousands of the 8,000 were doctors. And it is very important because at least one study has shown that when a patient regards the doctor as empathic, the patient is 19% more likely to follow the doctor's advice. That seems like a really big number.
Yeah, it does.
But we also find that it applies to everybody. And that's, so in order to help raise money for the Center for Communicating Science, I started a company called the Alda Communication Training Company, or the acronym is ACT.
Of course.
And we train in corporations. I have a program on women in business now. And the idea is, although it's a profit-making company, all the profits go to the Center for Communicating Science. So we're trying to do good in two regards. But you can use this to teach leadership and teamwork. The scientists who have trained with us tell us that their teamwork is much better as a result of it. People are collaborating better.
Are any of the scientists you've worked with good enough at improvising that they could go on to Second City?
No, because we don't teach comedy improvising. And most people know improvising only through the comedy improv that they've seen.
Yeah.
But in fact, we do a kind of improvisation that's really a set of basic exercises that, first of all, prepare you to be able to make contact with the other person. And you have to, you have to really observe them very carefully to play these games and do the exercises. But then when we do role-playing or other games where you have to make things up, sometimes it's funny, but it's really only funny because of the spontaneity of it.
So I'm curious, while we're talking about communicating, when you first came up with this and went to the first scientist or scientists and you wanted to explain to them what they should do to become better communicators, how did you communicate that to them? And were they reticent?
You know, in the beginning, it wasn't easy. We've been doing this for about 8 years now. And at first, I couldn't even find a university that wanted to start a center for communicating science. And Stony Brook University in New York was the only one who did it. Then, once we set ourselves up, we were trying to just teach it on campus before we even went out to other universities. And it was hard to find a professor who wanted to take the time to let his students study communication. Sometimes people would say, I have too much science to teach them, kind of ignoring the fact that communication is an essential part of science.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to collaborate, you got to communicate well, especially if it's across disciplines and you speak two different languages. But you got to communicate to get funding. You got to communicate to let other people know what your experiment was all about so they can try to replicate it and that kind of thing. So what's happened in the past 8 years, for a number of reasons, one of which is that this may be a small part of it, that we've become known for what we do, and the people who do it are really happy with the results. Another element, probably a bigger element, is that it's become clear to scientists that if they don't communicate better, they're not going to get funding, and they're not going to be regarded as doing work that's as beneficial as it is. In fact, to the whole country. We depend on science to to get us through economically and with good health and that kind of thing.
It's just like these tech startups I'm working with. You got to get the pitch right or you're not going to get the money.
Why would you give money to somebody if you don't understand what they want it for?
Right.
I mean, it's a human reaction. If you say, you're not going to give the money. In fact, that was what I thought might be the original title of the book. Huh? my editor talked me out of it, so I came up with this one.
Did helping scientists and business people and others improvise to communicate better help you as an actor?
Well, the concentration on this whole process of relating to the other person is something that I was not really good at as a young actor, and as time went on, I got better. And I think since I've been working on it with other people, helping them do it, I think I've got better at it. I see it in performances that I give. And I see it in real-life encounters with other people, with people I know well and people I don't know. You know what's really interesting about developing more empathy? And you can develop more. You can train yourself to be more empathic. And what's amazing about this is scientists have said that their studies have shown that empathy can make you more patient. I find people are less annoying now. That's really a benefit to me.
Yeah, that is. Since I mentioned your acting, I've got to ask you about a couple of projects of the many, many that you've done. I think the first time, Alan, that I saw you on screen was probably 1968 in Paper Lion when you played George Plimpton, who was telling the Detroit Lions that he'd once been the quarterback for the Newfoundland Noofs.
Yeah, the Noofs.
Did you know Plimpton?
I did, yes. I knew him, I forget how we met, but I knew him before I made the movie. And it was really fun to go through his experiences because he actually played, he trained with the Detroit Lions, and then he played in a real game with them.
Yep.
And made some horrible mistakes. I don't remember if he ran the wrong way with the ball, but he did smash into the goalpost.
Yes, he did.
Which I had to do at 5 o'clock in the morning at the stadium in St. Louis.
No stuntman?
No, I smashed into it about 82 times.
Did you? Well, let's see, that was 1968, so that would have probably been in the original Busch Stadium here.
I think so, yeah.
Wow. Since Plimpton wrote about the experience of doing other people's jobs, was he more interested in what you were doing in playing him than you were in playing him?
No, I think the main thing he was interested in was that I be that I show him not to be an adventurer, but to be a writer.
Yeah.
He said, he had read the script, and there was more fun being made at his expense to be as an amateur in among professional players. So he said, every chance you get, take out a notebook and make notes so it looks like I'm a writer.
Got it. I mentioned in my intro that you wrote and directed movies like The Seduction of Joe Tynan and Sweet Liberty and The Four Seasons. In fact, you made five of them between 1979 and 1990, but you haven't written and directed one since then. Why?
A lot of people want to be a director, and I directed a lot. I directed about 35 episodes on MASH, and I directed those movies that I wrote. It's not so thrilling to me to direct. It's okay. I like it, and it's fun to come up with something that works. But especially, the only ones I've directed are ones that I've actually written and been in, and that's just too much work to do. I like to be able to concentrate. If I'm going to be an actor, I can concentrate. I had one of the best experiences I've ever had was when I did a web series with Louis C.K. that he wrote and directed and acted in, and all I had to do was act, and I had the best time.
Yeah, Harold and Pete, and you were terrific in that.
Horace
and Pete, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and I just, thank you, but I just loved it.
Yeah. When you would direct, whether it was the TV show or the movies, did you allow improvising on the set?
No, and I should have. I wish I did.
I love the irony of that.
Yeah, I know, but I had struggled for years in every case to write what I thought was a good script, and I wanted it to be said the way I wrote it, when in fact, it's so much better. If I did it now, I'd give the actors much more leeway. Because if it comes out of them as though they own it, that's what you want.
Mm-hmm. Alan, I've been reading the blog of Ken Levine, who was one of the writers on MASH for many, many, many years. And he told a story about how to deal with complaining actors in the cast.
I didn't see that story. How does he do it?
He said that if people complained too much about a script, the next script they get would involve the cast having to shoot outdoors at the ranch in the summer heat while shooting scenes that would take place in the winter in Korea, and you'd all have to wear parkas in outdoor scenes.
So that explains it.
You never knew that?
No.
I do
remember the way they handled the character who left the show, McLean Stevenson.
Yeah.
When he left the show to do his own series, they were mad at him, so they didn't just let him leave Korea. They let his plane go down in the ocean.
Yeah.
So they said, you're leaving, you can't come back.
In one of the great episodes of that show, too.
It turned out to be great, but it's too bad for him that he didn't make such a good decision.
Yeah. Now, before I let you go, I've got to ask you for a quick explanation of the Flame Challenge.
Oh, that's really interesting. It's really fun. When I was 11 years old, I didn't know what a flame was. I was fascinated with it. What's going on in there? And I asked the teacher, what's going on in a flame? And she said, oxidation. So that didn't help. I didn't know what oxidation was.
Right.
So years later, I was thinking about that poor communication, and I thought, I'm going to start a contest where scientists around the world will be asked to make a video or write a short piece that will explain what a flame is so an 11-year-old can understand it. And 11-year-olds from all over the world will be the judges. They're the ones going to judge how good it is.
Mm-hmm.
And each year, it's a different question. This year it was, what is energy? And thousands and thousands of kids have been judges. The nice thing is the scientists get the experience of having to be clear and vivid to 11-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And the 11-year-olds get this amazing educational experience where they have to really be up on the subject enough to make a good judgment about which one is best. And they're very serious about it. One of their biggest complaints is that there's not enough information.
Huh. They don't want the scientists being funny.
Well, they don't mind it being funny, but one kid said, you don't have to be silly. He said, after all, we're 11, we're not 7.
That's one of the great stories you'll find in Alan Alda's book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? He continues to do work at the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, and hopefully will soon appear in another major motion picture like last year's Bridge of Spies, which you were terrific in as well.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.